For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 334. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. This episode was recorded on Sunday, November 22nd, 2020. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Hi, Bill. I'm doing well.
So as we said last week, we just have a few more episodes to go before the end of 2020, at which time we will be departing WVUD, our radio station home, for the past nearly a decade. And then we will be shifting to a podcast format and continuing to do a lot of the stuff that you like and adding in some new sort of areas as well. And we'll be doing a bonus episode each week. As we said, we'll have more information on that coming up as we get closer to that. But we just want to remind people that that is coming down the line. Today on episode 334, however, we are going to be talking about Joe Hill, who was executed 105 years ago this past week in November of 1915. And let's get into that. So Joe Hill is a singer that you might not know his name, but you probably know some of his work. He was involved with the Industrial Workers of the World, as we'll talk about, and wrote a number of famous songs that we're going to mention, and contributed some phrases to pop culture that remain in use today in some form or another. So Joe Hill was born Joel Hoglund, sometimes went by the alias Joseph Hillstrom, but he was Joel Hoglund when he was born in Sweden in 1879. His father was a railroad conductor who died at 41 and plunged the family into, dire straits economically. He also had a pretty tough time and probably wouldn't have lived super long anyway, I'm guessing, because he contracted tuberculosis fairly early in life. He was treated for that in Sweden, but as far as I can remember, I don't think anybody actually cured anybody's cases of tuberculosis until the 1940s with antibiotics and so forth. So he, although he died young due to his execution, he probably also knew that he didn't have a super long life to live, and that may have influenced some of his choices in lifestyle and so forth. So he did move to the U.S. at age 22 with his brother in 1902. I thought that was interesting because he must have somehow managed to get into the country despite having tuberculosis. I didn't think they were too keen on letting people in at the time who did, but somehow he got in. And then he became, as Wikipedia put it, an itinerant laborer crisscrossing the country. We'll talk about some of the specific professions that he had, but a lot of that is, seasonal migrant work. At various points, he was involved with, I think, farming and dock work and mining and that kind of thing. So he, this is a guy who rose to prominence pretty quickly toward the end of his life, and burned very brightly for about of a five-year period, not even really, probably 4.5 years or so. And that's going to make this a pretty short episode. But he joined the Industrial Workers of the World in 1910, approximately. At the time, he was a California dock worker, although later in the year, he was identified as a dock worker in Oregon. And he used the pen name Joe Hill to submit letters, cartoons, songs, and other writings to the IWW newspaper, The Industrial Worker. And he became pretty legendary pretty quickly, even though he only lived for a few years longer. What he was most famous for was his songwriting. Oftentimes, as was, you know, a popular custom then, you would take an existing tune that everybody knew and then change the words to it. And sometimes people would, you know, throw out the song completely. In his case, he often would take something from the content of the songs that was familiar with, and he would subvert it and make it into some sort of a mocking parody, often of well-known popular songs or especially religious songs from Christian revival groups who were proselytizing among homeless encampments, migrant farm camps, lumber camps, and mining camps, where the IWW was also trying to recruit. And a lot of these songs, he and others in the IWW felt were useful for communicating anti-capitalist ideas, trade unionist ideas, things like that, class consciousness in general, without being preachy in the form of a pamphlet or something like that, and that it had more, as we would call it today, replay value. And so there's a number of songs that you've probably heard, at least in some capacity. There Is Power in a Union is obviously probably the most famous one. There's another song called The Rebel Girl, which I'll circle back to in a minute. Another one called The Tramp, which was a rewriting of a famous song that became popular and was itself, I think, a rewriting from the American Civil War, where, you know, they would be going tramp, tramp, tramp and marching along. And it was a marching song. And he rewrote the lyrics to be literally about a tramp. Because that was often the kind of target audience that he had. He also wrote Casey Jones, The Union Scab. This was in support of the 1911 Illinois Central Shopman Strike and National Solidarity Strike. I think we'll probably do an episode on that at some point in a few months. Both of those strikes in 1911 and 1912 were undermined significantly by rail employees from rival unions filling in for the roles of the striking workers, which was therefore effectively scabbing against union men, hence the name of the song, Casey Jones, The Union Scab. And of course, Casey Jones, there was already a very popular song about him and how heroic he was and, you know, died keeping the trains running or whatever and saving his passengers, etc. And the premise here is that actually Casey Jones was operating, you know, equipment in an unsafe manner and could have gotten lots more people killed, etc., and that it would have been better to just not try to, you know, run the train by himself and keep things on time, etc. So kind of a funny subversion of that. And then another very famous one was his satirical hymn, The Preacher and the Slave. This was the origin of the phrase pie in the sky. That was a phrase that had never been used before and, of course, is still in current popular use all the time today. The first two verses in the chorus where that phrase comes from are as follows. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay, you'll get pie in the sky when you die. And the starvation army they play, and they sing and they clap and they pray, till they get all your coin on the drum, then they tell you you're on the bum. Anyway, I thought that was really interesting because, first of all, indicates that there was definitely a lot of people who didn't like the Salvation Army even back then. Obviously, more recently, there's been a lot of controversies about how anti-LGBTQ they are, but they're still extremely normalized within society and like a mainstream, despite being overtly religious, a mainstream sort of thing to find outside all manner of grocery stores and chain stores and things like that. And people just kind of accept that as a part of current American life. And the Salvation Army would be in these same type of places that Joe Hill would be traveling around to. And he did not care for them. And he wanted to undercut them with their sort of target audience. So he wrote explicit mention of that in the song. But again, that phrase pie in the sky comes from this song. And it is often misused to attack the left and attack socialists by saying, oh, you're offering pie in the sky ideas that will never happen. But the entire point of the song was that it's the sort of conservatives, the reactionaries, everyone who's telling you you can't have a better life here on earth. You can only have a better life in the next life in heaven, and you'll get pie in the sky after you die. And that is sort of a misunderstanding of the phrase from the song. So Joe Hill, as I alluded to, was a rail-hopping migrant worker, and that made him a key asset to the IWW's hobo rail networks for soapbox protests, which was a key tactic that we talked about previously of the IWW. They would quickly mobilize their rhetorical propagandists to show up on street corners in key cities to respond to events. And Hill's song, one of his last, called The Rebel Girl, was about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a legendary IWW soap boxer who had actually started as a teenager, and she was 25 when the song was released, and she would eventually serve as a leader of the Communist Party of the United States. But this song was basically, you know, saying that the role of women is to advocate for themselves and show class solidarity and build class consciousness, etc. So the Hobo Rail Networks, as we've talked about before, had a great deal of respect for the IWW and their signature red membership card. And rail hobos were obviously a target audience for these songs that Joe Hill was writing. Now, listeners might recall from our very long episode in 2019 on the history of the IWW, and here we're citing Patrick Renshaw's 1967 history, The Wobblies, The Story of Syndicalism in the United States, that the IWW had launched a 1913 campaign to organize seasonal farm laborers around the Midwest, who spent much of the year struggling to find work between harvests and then lived in horrid conditions during the harvest season. Another key step by the IWW was a 1914 convention decision to begin organizing the unemployed members of the working class, not only to help them find jobs, but also to make it easier for them to avoid serving as a surplus labor force of scab workers during strikes. Unfortunately, Joe Hill's arrest and demise in 1914 and 1915 came at a critical point in this migrant labor effort by the IWW. It's interesting to imagine what role he might have played if he hadn't been arrested. And this, even without him, the sort of push continued until 1916, the final year before the U.S. entry to World War I. According to Renshaw, the Agriculture Workers Organization for Seasonal Migrant Farm Workers was a massive force within the IWW by that point, and because they had been winning fight after fight with farm owners who couldn't let their crops spoil during a strike and therefore had to settle quickly, they were getting a lot of new members and raking in the dues money to the IWW. Ironically, this made the strongest branch of the IWW a highly decentralized union of seasonal and mostly unemployed farm workers. So that is the story of Joe Hill up until the point that he got arrested. As I said, a pretty short story, although he kept on writing various songs even after he was in prison. And we'll go now to Rachel to talk about what happened starting in January 1914. And again, this is just a few years after he had even started emerging into sort of prominence and recognition within the IWW by writing in his letters and his songs, etc., to their official newspaper.
Right. So in January 1914, Joe Hill was working in a mine in Park City, Utah. So at that time, a former police officer and his son were shot and killed in the Salt Lake City grocery store that they owned. Joe Hill got swept up. He was the 13th person arrested as a possible suspect. It was on pretty shady grounds. The two gunmen had worn red bandanas, which were presumably fairly common in like a mining community. So Hill had himself been shot that same night, and he had sought medical attention in Salt Lake City. The doctor claimed Hill had been armed when he arrived. It was clear from the hole in his shirt and his wound that he had his hands up when he did get shot. He said he had been shot in a dispute over a woman, and he did have a red bandana in his boarding room. So prosecutors found a dozen eyewitnesses to testify that Hill had shot the grocer and his son, and they coerced the victim's 13-year-old surviving son to recant his insistence that Hill looked nothing like the actual shooter. Hill did not know the grocer, and the store was not robbed, which was one reason it was originally presumed to be a hit. The media repeatedly emphasized Hill's reputation within the IWW, and Hill refused to testify or even explain to police about the nature of his injuries. It's likely that the former fiancé of a woman he was involved with shot him. He didn't want to drag her name through the mud in public. The likeliest actual suspect for the murders was a Norwegian criminal, Magnus Olsen, also known as Frank Z. Wilson. He went on to be armed muscle and getaway man for Al Capone, and he had been arrested in the earlier sweep of suspects. The jury deliberated for only a few hours before finding Joe Hill guilty anyway, and that meant the death penalty by firing squad. Hill himself wrote of the trial, quote, "Owing to the prominence of Mr. Morrison, there had to be a goat, scapegoat, and the undersigned being, as they thought, a friendless tramp, a Swede, and worst of all, an IWW, had no right to live anyway, and was therefore duly selected to be the goat. There was a rash of outrage and defenders from the IWW, such as Helen Keller, Samuel Gompers of the AFL also kind of rushed to his defense, the Swedish ambassador to the United States, and it was actually so appalling that President Woodrow Wilson even objected to the outcome. But being that it was a state case, not a federal case, he really couldn't like change the outcome in any way. The Swedish government and the Swedish public sought to intervene in the case too, but it all was in vain. Of note, Joe Hill's appeals lawyer, although unsuccessful this time, was the famous IWW defense attorney Orrin N. Hilton. We've previously talked about him with the Frank Stunenberg murder trial and the Sacco and Vanzetti trials. Hilton contended that Hill had carefully avoided emphasizing his own connections to the IWW, despite the media and prosecutors fixating on it, and that this was a factor in his refusal to take the stand in his own defense. It remains unclear whether Hill was deliberately allowing himself to be martyred or simply did not see any point in trying to defend himself against such an obvious frame-up. Joe Hill was executed by firing squad nearly 2 years after his arrest on November 19, 1915, which is 105 years ago this past week. But he had one final legendary phrase to offer to popular culture. He sent a telegram to Big Hill Haywood, another subject that we've talked about on the show before, with the following lines: "Goodbye, Bill. I die like a true blue rebel. Don't waste any time in mourning. Organize. Could you arrange to have my body hauled to the state line to be buried? I don't want to be found dead in Utah." So this phrase, "Don't waste any time in mourning. Organize," was kind of taken and paraphrased over the years. In 1967, Hunter S. Thompson reformulated a fragment of this into the pithier line, "Don't mourn, organize," which has been repopularized in the Democratic Party in recent years by a number of figures who came up in the 1960s political scene, including Senator Ed Markey, who had the even catchier formulation, "Don't agonize, organize." Joe Hill also released a rhyming poem as his last will and testament, requesting cremation. This was carried out in Chicago, November 29th, 2015. And I'll just share his will because it is very, very short. "My will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss or moan. Moss does not cling to rolling stone. My body, ah, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, and let the merry breezes blow my dust to where some flowers grow. Perhaps some fading flower then would come to life and bloom again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you, Joe Hill." He's kind of well known for these catchy, pithy phrases, and his will was no exception. Something else to note about his execution: it was said by one of the members of the firing squad that the order to fire actually came from him himself. So kind of showing that he walked to his execution pretty stoically, and he kind of knew how that would appear and kind of play to that. To his legend after he died.
Right, that's one of the reasons that it's kind of debated as to whether or not he intentionally allowed himself to be martyred, which, again, I think that maybe if he didn't have tuberculosis for most of his life, that might have been a different consideration. But knowing that he was going to probably die young anyway, I think, you know, it's definitely within the realm of possibility that he would have allowed himself to be executed for propaganda purposes without putting up much of a fight and trying to, you know, be as cool of a cucumber as possible about the whole thing.
Right. So in the aftermath, his body was shipped to Chicago, where he was cremated. And then on the 1 year anniversary of his death, there was an IWW meeting in Chicago at the West Side Auditorium. And 150 of 600 packets of his ashes were distributed to members there. The ashes were also mailed to every state but Utah. Again, he said, "I wouldn't be found dead there." Kind of another wry witticism from him. And these packets of ashes were even shipped internationally. Some of the ashes were found in the mail in 1917, And they were confiscated as subversive materials because at that time the IWW was anti-war and there was a real crackdown on them in those years. However, some packets of ashes ended up as far away as New Zealand. His ashes continued to be spread around the world by leftists and unionists for 75 years after his execution. There was kind of a famous piece of lore that his ashes were spread on May 1st, 1916. However, that doesn't really line up with the timeline where his ashes were distributed 1 year after his death. So I think it's just kind of an apocryphal story there. In 1988, a vial of his ashes that was in the National Archives because it was seized in the mail in 1917. A vial of his ashes were returned to the IWW, but the National Archives kept the original envelope that the ashes came in, kind of adding to the lore of him, of Joe Hill, even to this day. So something of note, these packets of ashes had his picture on the front, and it said, Joe Hill, murdered by the Capitol's class, November 19th, 1915. And then there was a line where it said who it was distributed by. So that's kind of interesting. You could see who is sending you a packet of Joe Hill's ashes. And then on the back was printed his will, that little poem. Some parts of his ashes were sent back to Sweden. And the main part of the ashes were actually interred in the wall of a union office in Landskrona, which is a minor city in the south of the country, with a plaque commemorating Hill, and that room is now the reading room of the local city library. So anyone can come and visit his ashes in that city. So over the years, these packets of ashes have been scattered all over the country and the world. In 1989, there was a ceremony in Lafayette, Colorado, which was also the unveiling of a monument to six unarmed coal miners that were buried there. They had been machine gunned by Colorado State Police in 1927 in the Columbine Mine Massacre. Until 1989, the graves of five of these men were unmarked. Another famous wobbly, Carlos Cortez, scattered Joe Hill's ashes on the graves at the commemoration. In 1990, the Southeast Michigan IWW General Membership Branch hosted a gathering of WOBs in the remote wooded area, at which a dinner followed by a bonfire featured a reading of Hill's last will, and then his ashes were released into the flames and carried up above the trees. The next day, one WOB collected a bowlful of ashes from the smoldering fire pit. At that event, several IWW members consumed a portion of Hill's ashes before the rest was consigned to the fire. There's also a story of Abby Hoffman, the well-known Yippie, saying that people should eat Joe's ashes to help keep him alive, basically. And he basically dared folk singer Billy Bragg to do so, and which he eventually did in 1989. Some wobblies came up to him at a concert, and they had a Union brewed beer and some of his ashes, and they said, hey, are you going to do this? And Billy Bragg did. He took a bite of ashes and then washed it down with the Union brewed beer. So that was kind of interesting. A lot of things have happened with Joe's ashes over the years, some very solemn and then some very joking and witty, much like Joe Hill himself.
As usual, all of the sources that we used will be up with our notes in a PDF with the episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com. This week we had articles from the LA Times, the Salt Lake City Tribune, and various other sources, in addition to, of course, there was a lot of good stuff in the Wikipedia article. Again, those are always up at arsenalfordemocracy.com with each episode. If you have ideas for people or events from left-wing American history that you would like us to cover, you can certainly send those in to us as suggestions, and we'll consider them for the coming months, especially after we transition into a podcast format after the end of December 2020. That's it for us today on Joe Hill. Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by. In that glorious land in the sky,
work and pray,
live on hay. You get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. And the Starvation Army, they play. They sing and they clap and they pray, till they get all your coin on the drum. Then they'll tell you when you're on the bum.
You will eat by and by.
In that glorious land in the sky,
work and pray.
Live on hay. You get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. Holy rollers and jumpers come out. They holler, they jump, and they shout. Give your money to Jesus, they say. He will cure all diseases today. You will eat by and by. In that glorious land in the sky,
work and pray.
Live on hay. You get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. Working men of all countries unite. Together for freedom we'll fight. When the world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain.
You will eat by and by.
When you learned how to cook and to fry.
Chop some wood.
Try to do you good.
Do you good.
You'll eat in the sweet by and by. That's no lie.